October 11th at 7:30 p.m. in the Tryon Festival Theater in the Granite Center for the Performing Arts. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is the second hour of the program. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us, the producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be doing the program we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do it every other month on a Monday. And our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And in his practice, he sees a lot of different folks. He sees children. He sees grown-ups, people with a variety of complaints. And so we started to do the show now, some years back, because we thought it would be a good opportunity to have a general Talk to the Doctor show. So if there is something that's on your mind, a concern that you have for yourself, could be for someone in your family, you are welcome to call. We also like to remind people on these programs, anytime we have a physician on, we'd like to also remind folks that we cannot diagnose over the phone. There are some limits to what we can do, but we do these shows to help you, maybe give you a place to start, a place that you can get some basic information, ask some basic questions, and then you might want to go ahead and pursue that with your own physician or someone who can see you. But in any case, your question's welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, David.
We have a caller ready to go in Newman, so we will do that. We'll talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
I was wanting to ask about what your opinion or treatment would be for a broken collarbone. My son broke his collarbone over the weekend, and of course you can't put a cast on it or anything, but could you speak to what you should and shouldn't do?
How old is he?
He's 14.
14. And was there any significant displacement? Were the broken ends moved afar apart from each other?
Not too badly, about the width of the collarbone,
okay.
Compared to me like.
Okay. You're correct. That's a kind of a tough place to put somebody in a cast to hold that in place, so generally that's not done. In most instances, at least traditionally, they have used what's called a figure of eight splint. It's simply a brace-like device that puts an individual in sort of the stand at attention position. It sort
right.
of throws their shoulders back and kind of holds them in place. All fractures heal by the ends of the fractures basically producing new bone and then kind of sticking to each other. And it takes probably 4 to 6 weeks for this new bone to become sticky and hard enough that you're not likely to disrupt the healing process. So in most instances, when somebody has a cast or a splint, all you're doing is simply holding the fracture pieces close enough together that the healing process can then allow the bone to heal up again. There isn't anything about a cast or a splint that actually causes the healing. You're simply trying to keep the ends physically adjacent to each other so that the body can put it back together. If you constantly move that fracture site, you simply disrupt the healing process. So for collarbone fractures, generally speaking, that military stand at attention kind of posture to pull the collarbone back into position, that splint is generally worn for 4 to 6 weeks. In most instances, you can tell that the fracture is healing well because when you push on it, it's not tender anymore, and you probably will have a fairly sizable bump at the site of the fracture. At 14, there's still a fair amount of bony growth to occur, so probably over the next 5 to 7 years, some remodeling of that bone will also take place, and the bump will probably become less noticeable with time.
Does that splint immobilize the shoulder enough to allow it to heal? That was my biggest concern.
Yes, the biggest problem is that in adolescent boys, you have a hard time keeping the splint on them. They don't want to wear it.
Right. He also wants to play basketball, too.
That's probably not going to work out too well.
I didn't think so. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Right,
thanks for the call. Others are welcome. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. This is a program we do every other month. We call it Talk to the Family Doctor, and the idea is that it's pretty much open to whatever questions you would want to ask, healthcare questions. 333-9455. That's the number if you're in Champaign, Urbana, where we are. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Anything that's particularly new that has come along in recent years when you're dealing with broken bones, or is it still the same kind of deal where you have to try to immobilize that part and then let the bone do its thing?
Right. The actual healing of the bone is still a very much a natural process that takes time. Within the orthopedic field, there are a variety of other things that can be done to help a non-healing fracture. And this includes electrical stimulation across the fracture site that seems to stimulate bone growth. There have been situations where people have needed to have bone put into their fracture site as a graft, again, to try and get something to heal. There are then mechanical devices, plates, screws, things that can be done much in a engineering type fashion to provide additional support to that bone. But the basic process is what it always has been, which is if you can hold the fracture ends close enough together for a long enough period of time, the vast majority of fractures will heal on their own. And that's essentially the only service that a cast or splint provides, is to simply hold the fracture fragments in place long enough to allow them to heal.
Okay. We were talking about flu and flu shots just a little bit before we got going here, and that's something that I'm sure people will soon be hearing more and more about thinking about.
That seasonal malady will soon be upon us. Mm-hmm. We're hopeful this year that there won't be quite the concern about shortage of vaccine that there was last year. The flu vaccination season usually starts towards the end of October, so I would anticipate in the next week or two that folks will start to see notices regarding flu shot clinics, and their personal physicians will probably also have access to vaccine. We usually review the indications for getting a flu shot. They have gradually expanded over the years. The traditional ones are anybody over the age of 65, since there's a higher degree of mortality with elderly folks in the flu, and certainly anybody with any chronic heart or respiratory disease. But of late, the younger age group, which generally don't necessarily have fatal reactions to the flu, but serve as a significant reservoir for flu that's then passed on to others in the community, is being recommended to be immunized. So the children 6 months to 2 years of age, and the other group that's recently been added are women who are currently pregnant. The flu shot can be very safely given in the second and third trimesters of pregnancy. And as such, these are considered the folks who are at high risk for having problems due to influenza, and those are the folks who should definitely make a point to become immunized.
Yeah, folks who remembered last fall, there was a shortage of vaccine. The health care industry said, well, we think that we have enough vaccine for the people who are in the high-risk groups, and that everybody else, wash your hands and cross your fingers. Do you think that this time around there would be enough vaccine so that anybody who wanted to get a shot is going to be able to get one?
At this point, I think that will be the case. I'm not aware of any information right now that indicates a shortage of the traditional flu shot. And in addition, I think most institutions are probably going to make sure that they have access to flu mist as well, which is the nasal spray used to help combat or prevent the flu.
Yeah. Is there any particular advantage to that form of administering the vaccine?
Only to those people who hate shots. Otherwise, the flu mist is not any more efficacious than the flu shot. It is more expensive, and it has a narrower age range for use. It only goes up to the age of 55. So primarily those folks over the age of 65 should indeed be getting a flu shot. The other difference between the shot, it uses a killed or completely inactivated virus, so there really is no risk of getting the flu from the flu shot. The flu mist uses an attenuated but still live virus, and there is a small risk of in a individual who would be immunocompromised, somebody whose defenses are down because of, say, chemotherapy or AIDS, that these folks would actually get the flu from the vaccination. So consequently, those people are advised not to use the flu mist. And in fact, if they're around other individuals who are immunocompromised, they shouldn't get the flu mist because there is a very small risk of transmitting that virus to others.
Mm. That was, in fact, that was one of the things that I thought I recalled also as being a potential issue about the flu mist, is that there was a possibility that you could infect somebody else, essentially, after having gotten this stuff yourself as your form of immunization.
That's correct. But it's generally thought to only be an issue if you are spending a significant amount of time in contact with individuals who would be unusually susceptible to the flu.
Mm-hmm. I think I just recall recently there having been some reporting on just how much of just how significant a disease reservoir small children were, and that in fact that there was this. Isn't it now that somebody's thinking that in fact they were saying that they're very important in transmitting flu because they're getting it, and then they are passing it. Not only are they passing it around among themselves, as kids will do if you mix them up in school and in daycare, but then also that's an important way that it gets spread to adults. They get it from their own kids.
That's exactly right.
So good reason to think about vaccinating, making sure that the kids are vaccinated,
right,
so that then they won't get it and pass it on to sister, mom, dad.
And that's all children. In the past, you know, we always targeted kids who had, say, underlying respiratory diseases like asthma. We, you know, encouraged them to get their flu shot. But now, for just the reasons that you mentioned, trying to vaccinate all six-month-olds to 2 years of age is an attempt to try and reduce the prevalence of the virus in the greater community.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and every other month is here. We do this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor, and the idea is that if you have some health question about yourself, about your some member of your family, could be kids, he deals with them, little ones in his practice, and also grown-ups too, people of all ages. So whatever kind of question you might have, you can give us a call. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILO and toll-free 800-222-WILO. Anything else in generally in the way of, we probably have this conversation every time we get to this season, about prevention. The bugs are out there, and short of staying in your house and not going out and eliminating all contact with other human beings,
right,
is there much that you can do to try to minimize your chances of getting sick this coming winter?
Well, again, as you pointed out, it's typically the sort of crowded indoor contact with others who are either ill or carrying the virus that exposes you to coming down with it as well. For folks who are really serious about it, you're going to avoid the big crowded areas. You are definitely going to practice thorough hand washing after coming in contact with anything out in the public. And for individuals at particularly high risk who can't avoid the crowd, say a mask, a respiratory mask, is a reasonable thing to consider as well. But in many instances, it's not terribly easy to avoid all of the opportunities that there are to come down with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, I was about to launch another question, but I'll just wait because here's a caller, someone who wants to talk with us, someone listening in Piatt County. That's line number 4. We'll go right there. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about the relationship between peptic ulcer and calcium supplements that women are recommended to take nowadays, specifically calcium carbonate and the acid rebound effect.
You bring up a point that has been known about for a little while. We think of a lot of the antacid medications as being helpful to try and decrease acid in our stomach. And because of their buffering effect on stomach acid, they do indeed work. What has been also shown is that calcium by itself is a direct stimulant of acid production. And there have been concerns expressed that calcium-containing products, vitamins, supplements, could potentially worsen peptic ulcer disease. What has been discovered most recently, I would say in the last 5 to 7 years, is that most serious peptic ulcer disease is associated with the presence of a bacteria called H. pylori. And testing for this and then treatment of this particular bacterial organism actually eradicates peptic ulcer disease. The remaining issues related to stomach acid generally turn out to be fairly minor, and unless somebody's unusually sensitive to the calcium, probably is not going to be a major problem and by itself should not produce actual ulcer disease. So women who need calcium or are taking it on a regular basis in one form or another for prevention of osteoporosis are probably going to be encouraged to continue to do so unless they have had some sort of extenuating circumstance with other ulcer problems. If they're having ongoing stomach-related problems that they think are related to their calcium, and they haven't been screened for H. pylori, they probably need to.
Does that get at your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Well, let's go on to another caller here, someone on a cell phone, line number 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
You're on your program.
Thanks.
I just have a curiosity thing I'd like to settle. When I was very young, medical teams came through our schools and they vaccinated everyone for smallpox. That was back in the days when they still did that. Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
Phone line went real quiet. I must have a real good connection. Everyone else, you know, scabbed up and ended up with a scar. I never did. As a matter of fact, they treated me a second time. The doctor was a little puzzled at the time. He said he thought it was maybe I just had natural immunity. I'm just kind of curious. It's something I wonder about all these years. Is there such a thing as having a natural immunity? I mean, the vaccination never seemed to have done anything.
In most individuals who respond to the vaccination, the smallpox vaccination usually left a little bit of a mark.
Yeah.
And it's either possible that you were already immune to smallpox and didn't generate much of a response to that. And there are other types of illnesses that are similar to smallpox.
That's what I was wondering.
That if somebody had been exposed to, might have conferred a similar kind of immunity. Alternatively, if you didn't generate any response at all, the major concern would be, you know, is there something wrong with your immune system such that you're not generating a response? If that were the case, you'd have had a whole lot of other troubles with infectious diseases over the years. So that seems, you know, pretty unlikely. So the most likely explanation is you'd simply been exposed to something similar to it previously.
Like chickenpox or something, would that be similar to it?
There are actually a number of them that are related to smallpox, so yes.
Okay. I was just always kind of curious about that. Everybody else seemed to get a scar, and I kind of felt left out. All right, thank you. That's all I have.
All right, thanks for the call.
Bye.
Let's see. We have another person here. This is also someone who was on a cell phone here, line number two. Hello. It's a caller there on line two.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I was wondering about the increasing incidence of liver poisoning or whatever you call it from medication. I know that they do blood tests to check for the cholesterol medication that I'm supposed to be taking. I know some people who have died from liver disease that was brought on because of medications they were taking. And so I just wonder, are you seeing much in the way of liver problems? And how do you balance the danger of liver damage with cholesterol-lowering medication in particular?
Okay. I think that's a very good question because certainly in the U.S., cholesterol-related problems are virtually epidemic. There is a good body of medical evidence that says especially the bad forms of cholesterol are strongly associated with the development of heart disease. And heart disease is still the number one cause of death in the United States, far exceeding anything else that you can name. And there's also very good medical evidence that says if you get your cholesterol down, that your risk of heart disease is significantly reduced. So there's a great deal of interest in trying to lower people's cholesterol. To the extent that people can adequately improve their diet and their exercise habits, in many instances, cholesterol can be improved without the need for medication. There are some instances where people either can't change their cholesterol due to hereditary factors, or they're simply unwilling to adopt the dietary and exercise habits that would improve their cholesterol. If you use medications, the most recent medications are called statin medications, and there's a half a dozen drugs in this chemical class. But if you use these, we know that they alter cholesterol metabolism in your liver. That's where most of your cholesterol metabolism occurs. So it's not surprising that, you know, there are concerns about, well, what else is going on in my liver as a result of this medication? And that's why you should have baseline laboratory work checked to make sure that your liver is functioning normally before you start on these medications. And certainly anybody with pre-existing liver disease should be very, very careful about any medication that can potentially affect their liver. But assuming that they're normal, you would start on some cholesterol medication, and then in about 6 to 8 weeks, you would have blood drawn to check your cholesterol again to make sure it's coming down, and you'd also have laboratory work checked for your liver functions, which I would say in 99% of the cases remain quite normal. It's actually pretty unusual to have to stop somebody because of liver-related problems.
How often do they need to continue checking for liver problems?
Every 6 months.
Okay.
You should continue to get your laboratory work checked for liver functions every 6 months as long as you're on that type of cholesterol-lowering medication.
You're really not seeing much in the way of problem.
No, because in fact, anybody who has even a mild change in their liver function tests is usually taken off of their medication at least long enough to figure out, you know, why did these tests change. Sometimes it's due to some other illness. Sometimes it's due to, say, alcohol intake, Tylenol overdose, some other kind of viral illness or some other medication in combination with what they're taking. It's actually very unusual to have to stop somebody's medication because of liver-related problems. And almost all liver-related problems are reversible if the medication simply stops. So as long as it's being monitored appropriately, it would be very unusual to have somebody with a significant ongoing serious liver problem.
Okay. I happen to know three people, two of whom actually died of liver problems related to medication. They were thought to have been heavy drinkers, but were not at all. Maybe it's just unusual that I happen to have those acquaintances.
And obviously I can't. You know, I don't have enough information to comment on their specific medical condition.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. We are about midway through this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month with a show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And whatever's on your mind, you have medical questions. It could be about yourself, could be somebody in your family, grown-ups, kids, what have you, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe just one quick thing we might mention, because you mentioned the possibility that Tylenol can cause liver problems. Just now that we are heading into the cold and flu season, people should be aware of, if they're taking some kind of medication to relieve their symptoms, one of those things that's available over-the-counter, it has a bunch of different things in there, something for a cough, something for a fever, something for congestion, all that stuff loaded up. Some of those medicines do indeed have Tylenol in them. If you're taking that, don't take extra Tylenol, because you can get in a situation where maybe you would be taking too much. So it just... As the bottom line is, when you're buying those kind of over-the-counter things, look at the package and know what's in there. And it's probably a good idea to say, do I have the symptom? Do I need this? Do I need to take this thing for it? You might as well not take something if you don't have that problem, don't take the medicine for it.
And along those same lines, and this may be probably old news to everybody, but during the treatment of the fever from influenza, it is not recommended to use aspirin, especially in children, because of the concern about Reye syndrome, which seems to be directly related to influenza and aspirin use. It's also sometimes seen with chickenpox and aspirin use as well. So at least in children, Tylenol is a good choice for their temperature control, but your point is very well taken that a number of combination products over the counter may indeed already have Tylenol in them.
Yeah. Is it, I think probably there was that concern, so we got to the point where generally we're recommending not giving aspirin to kids anymore. There are some people who have difficulty taking aspirin because it can cause gastric problems, so for that reason, maybe more and more people, for their routine, for if they have a headache or if they have a muscle ache or something like that, probably a lot of people who might have grown up using aspirin have switched and are using Tylenol or something like that. Is there, aside from the fact that it seems that it can be of benefit to people who are at risk for having heart disease, very small dose of aspirin on a daily basis can apparently help that. Is there any real place for aspirin anymore? It seems to be there would have been a time when in everybody's medicine cabinet you would have opened up and it would have had aspirin in it.
Aspirin is still an excellent anti-inflammatory and analgesic agent, and consequently in adults who have aches and pains, arthritis type of discomfort, if you want to use aspirin instead of ibuprofen instead of naproxen, that's perfectly okay. But as you point out, the amount that you're going to take may indeed irritate your stomach, and the dosing of aspirin is pretty hefty if you're trying to get a good anti-inflammatory dose. So there are better anti-inflammatory medications from the standpoint of tolerability. But for individuals who, you know, have a cast iron stomach and want to use aspirin instead of ibuprofen, that's perfectly okay.
Does it make very much difference if you try? There are products like that that are packaged with a kind of a coating around the pill that's supposed to help.
What's referred to as enteric coated aspirin basically allows the drug to pass through the stomach and then dissolve farther down in the intestinal tract, and that does indeed minimize the chance of bothering the stomach from the medication, and those do help.
Okay. We have a couple of other callers here. Someone next in Danville. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I would like for you to discuss the long-term use of acetaminophens or those kinds of products for osteoarthritis.
That's a very, very good question because, interestingly, they've done a lot of studies with acetaminophen, which the brand name most commonly used is Tylenol, and basically have found that in blinded studies, patients with osteoarthritis do just as well on Tylenol as they do on any other type of anti-inflammatory medication. Tylenol is an analgesic but doesn't really have any anti-inflammatory effect, and this probably goes back to the fact that osteoarthritis or degenerative joint disease is more of a mechanical wearing and tearing, and which produces discomfort in the joint, as opposed to an active inflammatory process like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, where there is active joint inflammation causing destruction and pain. In those areas where you have active inflammation, the anti-inflammatory medications actually work well. But the vast majority of, quote, you know, common arthritis that people have is generally mechanical and not inflammatory. And consequently, Tylenol works as well for those folks as any of the other, you know, traditional arthritis medications. The ones that are available over the counter are, as we mentioned before, ibuprofen, which is sold as Motrin and Advil, or naproxen, which is sold as Aleve. These are anti-inflammatory agents that also have analgesic effects, generally pretty well tolerated. There are a whole host of prescription anti-inflammatory medications, which generally have never been found to be any stronger or more efficacious than what's available over the counter. Now, there's always differences in people, and some people say this works for me and this one doesn't. And that can be true on the basis of just the chemical composition of the medication and that individual's response to it. There's probably at least a half a dozen different types of anti-inflammatory agents that are used to treat arthritis. And sometimes people respond one better to one than to another, but unfortunately there isn't any good way to predict that in advance when you're prescribing it. But when somebody says, you know, what's the strongest, what's the best, the answer is, you know, really whatever works for you, because none of them have been shown to be, you know, head and shoulders better than any of the others.
Well, in that instance, people are taking these for years. I'm concerned about overdosing. My neighbor had been taking 8 Tylenol a day. I sometimes take 2 and often none because I just don't want to risk any consequences.
Of all the medications used to treat arthritis, Tylenol is probably the safest, though as we...
Even over long periods of time.
As long as the total daily dose isn't being exceeded, and as long as some other condition, especially related to liver health, isn't introduced.
Uh-huh.
The biggest problem with Tylenol is in overdose, it can cause liver failure. But that's, again, not something that occurs commonly, except in situations where people are, you know, trying to overdose. A Tylenol can be actually quite serious because it can lead to liver failure, and the only treatment for that is transplant. So, but if you're not exceeding the, you know, manufacturer's recommended daily dose, and you don't have any pre-existing liver disease, and you don't add anything else into the mix that's going to change liver function, Tylenol is probably your safest choice compared to any of the other arthritis medications.
Oh, then thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Let us go on. And the next caller here we have in line is in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi, David. I have a question, Dr. Surgeon, on cysts. I have had an ovarian cyst, and my daughter has now turned up with them. And the latest is that they have found a cyst in my liver. My question is, what tests do you go about performing to determine whether it is, in fact, a cyst or might be a malignancy?
It depends on, to a large extent, you know, how it came to be that the cysts were found.
This was from a CT scan.
All right. That was looking for what?
Plaque in the arteries, which I don't have, but they found
this thing in the liver.
Liver, which they explained seemed very much to be a cyst,
right.
3 centimeters size.
Right. And basically, if you either CT scanned or MRI'd or ultrasounded everybody from the top of their head to the bottom of their feet, you would find us all littered with cysts in various organs.
Uh-huh.
You have what is referred to as an incidental finding.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't having liver problems.
No.
And I'm assuming that you didn't have, you know, worrisome symptoms of, you know, unexplained weight loss and weakness and fevers and things where people are concerned that your liver is failing or that you've developed some sort of malignancy. In those particular settings, what's generally recommended if the radiologist can, based on very specific criteria, say this meets all of the criteria for a simple cyst, mm-hmm. what's usually recommended is to simply take a look at it again a few months down the road. Mm-hmm. The longer it sits there and the more it doesn't do anything, the more they can say, this is just part of you.
Yeah, okay. Do they ever just recede and go away on their own? Or do they just sort of...
They just generally just sit there.
Okay.
They're not associated with...
They don't interfere with function.
No. They don't cause any malfunction of the liver itself. The difficulty in, quote, proving what something is, the 100% gold standard is to get a piece of it,
mm-hmm.
which means then somebody has to biopsy your liver.
Yeah.
Well, that's not necessarily something I would want to have done unless somebody was really, really suspicious that I had a problem there.
Yeah. Well, years ago, back in 1975, this ovarian cyst showed up, and mm-hmm. I suppose the imaging techniques were less sophisticated at that point.
Yes.
But anyway, the idea was they couldn't tell anything until they made a very large cut, and in that case, they discovered that it was, in fact, a benign cyst.
Mm-hmm.
It was rather on the large side, but I don't know, if they tend to grow but they still remain cysts, do they become more dangerous in some way?
No. You may have found that in the past ovarian cysts rupture
mm-hmm.
and can be a source of discomfort.
That was mentioned.
Right.
That they might rupture.
That's unlikely in the liver.
Oh, okay.
Because they're contained within the body of the liver. The ovary is sort of more freely just sort of hanging out in the pelvis. There isn't anything much to compress or constrict a cyst that develops on your ovary, unlike the ones in your liver.
Yeah, okay. Do you have time for one more question?
Sure.
Since arthritis was brought up on the call before, another one of my problems, but it seems as, although you say it's a matter of mechanics and just too much rubbing over a period of time, some people get it and others don't. There must be some sort of predisposition in the individual.
And there's a Nobel Prize waiting for you if you can figure out who's going to get it and who's
because
not.
Because we may figure out how to stop it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And along those lines...
Not anywhere near... No ideas on that at all?
That's a research area that I'm afraid I'm not familiar with. Yeah. But, you know, since you brought the arthritis subject back up, one of the things that I, you know, didn't mention but do want to emphasize is there are a lot of non-medication strategies for managing the discomfort of arthritis as well. Things, you know, as simple as, you know, a warm bath, some stretching exercises, remaining physically active in terms of either, you know, physical therapy or a rehab program. For many of our patients who can't participate really vigorously in sports anymore, Tai Chi has been shown to be an excellent form of very gentle exercise that improves the functioning and feeling in joints. So there are a number of non-medication things that can also be done to keep people comfortable.
Yeah, I think what bothers most of us is the stiffness. That's certainly my problem.
Right.
It isn't, you know, severe pain or anything. It's just if you happen to have to sit somewhere for 2 hours, it's almost impossible
to get up at
get
the end
up
of that.
Again, and I'm, right. But it feels as if it's in the muscle right. of the leg as opposed to either the knee or the hip.
Right. And you're quite correct. And trying to avoid that prolonged yeah. immobility where you're in just one position can be very helpful.
Yeah, but it what is the joint doing to the muscle that the muscle reacts that way?
The term gelling is commonly used in reference to the joint. It's almost like starting your car when it's cold. The oil hasn't warmed up. It's not very fluid yet. It's not circulating well. It's thought that the joint itself is gelling, and that it takes a fair amount of activity again to kind of warm up the fluid that lubricates the joint and make it comfortable again to move.
Okay, well, thank you. You've been very generous with your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go.
One last thing in that regard. Mm-hmm. Some people have found an over-the-counter supplement called glucosamine to be helpful for the discomfort associated with osteoarthritis or degenerative joint disease, not necessarily the inflammatory diseases, but the wear and tear kind of arthritis. Mm-hmm. And I've told my patients that the glucosamine, because it's a supplement and not so much a drug or a medication, for most people is a very reasonable thing to try. In and of itself, not a pain pill, not an anti-inflammatory agent, basically a supplement that over time, 4 to 6 months, may be helpful in the body producing a better form of cartilage within the joint, something that functions better, something that feels better to them. So I tell people if they want to try some glucosamine for the next 4 to 6 months, that's probably a reasonable thing to try. And I think probably 50% or more have gotten benefit from that. Now, if you don't get any benefit from it, there's no point in continuing to take it. But it's one of those things that there's probably not much downside to trying. And I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to give a shot.
Yeah. I know if folks have gone to the pharmacy or someplace like that where these kind of things are sold, there are a variety of them. They're packaged different ways
yeah.
in different combinations. Is it your recommendation that if people are going to try it, you would say just glucosamine by itself?
Well, glucosamine is often, as you say, packaged and sold in conjunction with chondroitin sulfate.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the medical information seems to imply that it's the glucosamine that does most yeah. of the work. So I tell people just buy plain glucosamine, and you're looking at about 1,500 milligrams a day.
Okay. All right, to another caller here in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My question is about this cholesterol and telling that for the some people, they tell that it is genetic. Now, if somebody has that kind of cholesterol, how high over 200 is high?
Actually, the numbers remain the same, whether your cholesterol is up because of your diet or whether it's genetic. If your cholesterol is above 200, then you're probably needing to do something to bring it down. And if in that particular setting diet and exercise aren't going to bring it down, then you're looking at some type of medication to try and help get that down. But there isn't a different set of values for genetically determined cholesterol versus cholesterol that's a function of your lifestyle.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions are welcome. We have maybe about 5 minutes here with Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carle Clinic in Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that the sort of the target top level for cholesterol is 200. You'd like for people to be under 200.
Correct.
And that then if somebody was over that, then the first thing you would say is work on the lifestyle stuff before we start talking about medication.
That's correct.
Where though, I mean, if someone's cholesterol was 210, 215, how concerned do you get about? I mean, at what I can understand, you know, saying okay, 200, but at what point do you really start to say okay, this is
I don't know if we've discussed this before or not, but let's put this in a larger context. 20 years ago, the normal value for cholesterol in the United States was up to 300.
Whoa.
Why? Because if you took 100 Americans and drew their blood and averaged their cholesterols, the normal range went up to 300. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you look at the rest of the world, the average cholesterol is 150.
Mm-hmm.
So by the United States saying that the upper limit of normal is 200, we're already saying, well, gee, that's 50 points higher than the average in the rest of the world. So what we have in the United States is a population that throughout the entire population has higher than average cholesterol readings, which is thought to be why we have a much higher than average cardiovascular death rate. Now, I don't particularly want to go to a third world country to avoid heart disease, but in fact, they're not dying of cardiovascular disease. They're dying of other things, but it's not heart disease because their cholesterol levels are 150, give or take, you know, 10 or 20 points above or below. So 200 for an American is already high when compared to worldwide averages. Now, You ask the question, okay, my cholesterol's up a little bit. Well, how bad is that? We would basically say additional information can be gained from looking at the breakdown between your good, the HDL, and your bad, the LDL, cholesterol. In situations where even the cholesterol's up just a tiny bit, but you have very, very low levels of your good cholesterol, and almost all of your cholesterol is bad cholesterol, that is a high-risk cardiovascular situation. That is somebody who has marked themselves as being at much higher risk for cardiovascular disease. And yes, treatment would indeed be indicated. Now, ideally, that treatment is change your diet, change your exercise. But in some instances, even people who do all the right things, their cholesterol doesn't improve because genetically they have inherited a form of metabolism that basically gives them too much bad cholesterol. Those folks usually have a strong family history of heart disease as a result of having this kind of cholesterol. And those are the folks who are going to benefit most from medication.
Okay.
Because we can lower it significantly.
I want to see if we can get one more caller at least. And that would be Urbana Line 1 right here. Hello.
Hi. Okay, I have a question. How would one suspect that they might have an ulcer? And I would like to ask if this might be a potential symptom of one. Every now and then I may take like ibuprofen or Tylenol. And it's not every day or, you know, it's just once in a while. But if I don't eat something, I get the most horrible, horrible pain in my stomach, like right under my breastbone in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned it to my doctor, and they just, she's kind of like, that's strange. And I noticed that the first time it happened, I actually thought I was dying. But afterwards, I figured out if I eat or drink something really quick, I can sort of stop it. Or does that just sound like something weird?
No, actually, some people are quite sensitive to the irritating effects of ibuprofen, which would be the Advil. It's very uncommon for people to be irritated by Tylenol.
Mm-hmm.
That's Nuprin, not typical.
Nuprin. What would that be? The blue pill, Advil, Nuprin. Is that an NSAID?
I think that's ibuprofen.
Right,
oh, okay.
That's a different brand,
yeah.
All right.
But still an anti-inflammatory agent.
Okay.
And all anti-inflammatory agents should always be taken with food. You should really never take them on an empty stomach because, in fact, people can very easily be irritated by it. If you don't have any trouble at any other time, other than when you're taking medication on an empty stomach, it's highly unlikely that you have an ulcer. But you do indeed have a sensitive stomach, and you should always take that type of medication with food first.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just generally, what would be the symptoms of ulcer?
Typically, as our last caller mentioned, that epigastric area, right underneath the center of the breastbone, typically a burning kind of discomfort. If you get reflux, that burning sensation will move up into the middle of your chest or sometimes higher. It can sometimes be aggravated by certain things that we eat and drink. We typically tell people to avoid tobacco, alcohol, caffeine, and any of the anti-inflammatory agents. Symptoms will usually improve with some of the antacid, the Maalox, Mylanta, Pepcid, Zantac, or even now available is the Prilosec OTC. Those are all medications that can either neutralize acid or block the production of acid. If symptoms are ongoing despite regular use of any of those medications, somebody should probably see their physician.
All right. There we will leave it for this time around with our thanks to Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month, so I guess that means we'd see you in December?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. The broadcast today made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed, hand-knotted, Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination from new to antique to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from the Great Impasta, restaurant serving foods from northern Italy, the Impasta at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we're going to talk about nursery rhymes. Many rhymes were born of religious hatred, political strife. Many contain violent references and sexual innuendo. Our guest at 106 will be Chris Roberts. He's the author of Heavy Words, Lightly Thrown. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago